Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. Dan Rodericks here, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 342. But Thursday, January 11th, 2018. Politics on the show today. National politics with Herb Smith. Maryland politics with Malia Cromer. Did you catch Donald J. Trump the other day in a meeting with members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, to discuss immigration reform? It was kind of extraordinary because it signaled that maybe Trump, a demagogue on immigration, might want to work something out, maybe even a path to citizenship, for the estimated 11 million people who are in the country without official authorization, maybe even a break for the thousands of undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States illegally by their parents and were eligible for work permits under an Obama initiative called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, the Dreamers. Trump rescinded DACA in September and gave Congress 6 months to come up with a replacement. For a moment on Tuesday, Trump looked like he was open to putting DACA back into effect without any strings attached. Listen to this exchange. The Democratic senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, appears to get a concession from Trump, but then Kevin McCarthy, the Republican majority leader in the House, steps in to put a stop to any softening of Trump's position.
Senator, would you like to say something, Dianne?
I would. As you know, we tried for comprehensive immigration reform in the Senate.
Yes.
It was on the floor. There were a number of amendments. It got a lot of attention in the Judiciary Committee, and then the House didn't take it up. What about a clean DACA bill now, with a commitment that we go into a comprehensive immigration reform procedure?
I have no problem. I think that's basically what Dick is saying. We're going to come out with DACA. We're going to do DACA, and then we can start immediately on the phase two, which would be comprehensive.
Would you be agreeable to that?
Yeah, I would like to do that. Go ahead. I think a lot of people would like to see that. But I think we have to do DACA first.
Mr. President, you need to be clear, though. I think what Senator Feinstein's asking here, when we talk about just DACA, we don't want to be back here 2 years later. You have to have security, as the secretary would tell you.
But I think that's what she's saying.
I think she's saying something different.
Okay, so given that, it makes perfect sense that by today, Republicans in the House are taking a hard line on immigration reform, making it clear that while Trump might have been trying to play nice the other day, the official position of the GOP is no soup for you. They want to crack down further on illegal immigration and sharply reduce the number of legal immigrants to the United States. There was another part of the Trump meeting with congressional members we should listen to. It has to do with chain migration, a term that describes what used to be called family reunification. That is, a person immigrates to the United States legally, then in due time, he or she can bring family members into the country as well. A lot of conservatives want to put an end to this practice, and as you'll hear, Senator David Perdue of Georgia warned Trump that there will be no deal on immigration generally unless something is done about chain migration. Listen to where this goes.
Once we get DACA done, if it's done properly with, you know, security and everything else, if it's done properly, we have taken a big chunk of comprehensive out of the negotiation, and I don't think it's going to be that complicated. Yes.
We have to be very clear, though.
Go ahead.
In my opinion, we'll be right back here either 5 years, 30 years, whatever. But this, the chain migration is so insidious. It is the fundamental flaw in the immigration policy of the United States. If any conversation about DACA is being held without that consideration, I agree with border security as well, but any conversation about that is not going to go anywhere in the United States Senate. And if we think we're going to divide one side versus the other, that's just not going to happen on this issue.
David, I think chain migration has taken a very big hit over the last 6 months. The man on the West Side Highway that killed the people and so badly wounded. You know, it's incredible when they talk about wounded. They don't say that arms are off and legs are off. One person lost two legs. You know, nobody talks about it. They said eight died, but they don't talk about the 12 people that have no legs, no arms, and all of the things. So I'm talking about everybody. I really believe that when you talk about the subject that we're all mentioning right now, I think they had, how many people came in? 22 to 24 people came in through him. He's a killer. He's a guy who ran over many people. Eight died. 10 to 12 are really badly injured. So I really think that a lot of people are going to agree with us now on that subject.
By the way, that statement by Trump that the Uzbek immigrant charged with the truck attack in New York City in December had brought more than 20 relatives into the country, that's apparently an unsubstantiated claim. BuzzFeed could find no federal official who could confirm it. And Mark Krikorian, executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, which wants reduced immigration, told BuzzFeed that Trump's claim made no sense. There's no way that in 7 years someone would be able to bring 23 people into the United States, Krikorian said. Chain migration doesn't work that fast. No surprise that Trump just makes stuff up to back up his arguments, and as Herb Smith, longtime professor of political science at McDaniel College here in Maryland, points out, it's common practice at the White House for Trump to say something and to contradict himself or have his staff walk back or try to explain what Trump was trying to say. Bipartisanship? Yeah, that's good for about a minute.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as his handlers, you know, get to him and explain that he can't be conciliatory, he can't be bipartisan, it'll stop. I think at the core, assuming the narcissistic personality disorder is still fully functional within the president, the greatest thing that he wants is acceptance and approval by the much-attacked mainstream media, especially the New York Times.
Do you really think so?
I truly believe that, you know, deep in his core, he wants that. You know, part of the leap of Donald Trump from his father, Fred, was the move from Queens into Manhattan real estate. And, you know, his father said, you know, we don't belong in Manhattan, it's too high scale, et cetera. But, you know, Trump jumped into Manhattan. When you do that, it's a real shift in your thinking from, you know, very, very parochial to cosmopolitan. And I do believe that, you know, year after year after year, reading the New York Times, et cetera, that he wants their approval. Along with that, there's this enormous dependency on his base. And the base and the approval of the New York Times are highly incompatible. So it sets up this, you know, very unstable dynamic within his personality.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis of that. I didn't know what to make of it at first. I thought, why is he going here? Because the red meat that he's been offering since the campaign was to usher as many illegal immigrants out of the country, certainly don't provide a path to citizenship. That's one of those code phrases that conservatives get really rankled about, the idea that you're rewarding illegal immigration.
DACA is very much a third rail issue for the Trump base. I went on Breitbart to read the comments. And of course, whenever you do that, you have this need for a shower afterwards. They are absolutely livid on the possibility that there'll be comprehensive immigration reform, which, you know, the president said, I don't think it's going to be that complicated, which is why it, you know, it hasn't happened for 20 years because of partisan polarization.
Why are they so opposed to DACA? I mean, understand not being interested in or opposed to a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants, but what is it about the kids who grew up in this country that sets them off?
Because immigration, particularly of non-European source, is really the hot and button issue, which I think in many ways was the decisive issue in 2016 for Trump voters. There were a number of comments that simply said that if President Trump did this, you know, they were taking a walk, that this would guarantee a Democratic Party landslide in 2018. I went to Breitbart, and I do so not on a daily basis, but with some regularity, because I think it's an excellent site to try to understand the thinking of, you know, 30 to 35% of the electorate.
I would just say, for historical reference, when Donald Trump announced that he was running for president, he opened with comments about immigrants, and specifically Mexicans and associated immigrants with criminality.
But some were good people.
Yeah, some.
You know, last year when I did this podcast, I opened up with a Game of Thrones reference that the 2016 election was the you know nothing Jon Snow election.
You know nothing, Jon Snow. You know nothing, Jon Snow. You know nothing, Jon Snow.
In reference to political scientists and various political analysts and pundits. And I've been trying to come up with the first year of the Trump administration Game of Thrones reference, and I think I have one. I think I have a good one, which is simply Ramsay Bolton's signature line.
If you think this has a happy ending, you haven't been paying attention.
And two thoughts came to me, from that. Essentially, the Trump has demonstrated to any number of candidate wannabes that crazy sells. And you saw that in Alabama with Roy Moore. And we're seeing that in Arizona with Sheriff Joe is now running for the U.S. Senate in the Republican primary, which he can do since he was pardoned.
By the president.
And by the president. Essentially, Arizona, which is kind of a purple state. Trump won there by 3 points over Hillary in 2016. But this is Jeff Flake's seat.
Right.
And he's retiring. And it could well be a pickup for Democrats. And the Senate, of course, is a very difficult pickup for Democrats in 2018. But I also have the feeling that, you know, what Trump has done is, and what some of his minions have done, is essentially setting the Democrats up to an actual issue-oriented campaign in 2008-2020, kind of regardless of the personalities. And two issues, I think, have emerged that are waiting to be picked up. The first is Medicare for All. If you destroy Obamacare and certainly the tax reform, which I call the Ayn Rand Memorial Tax Scheme Act of 2017, knocked out one of the major pillars of the ACA. Medicare for All could well be a major policy platform for the Democrats. But also the most recent thing that I think is just shoot yourself not only in the foot but the torso and the head is Attorney General Jeff Sessions' retreat from the invalidating the Cole memo of 2013 that essentially made the federal government stay away from states that had legalized marijuana. I don't think it takes much of a leap of faith for Democrats to advocate the national legalization of marijuana. State and local candidates in 2018 and national candidates in 2020. The idea of revoking the legalization of marijuana in the 8 states where it's entirely legal, or the 22 states that have it for medical use, such as Maryland, it's just a brain dead policy idea out of Attorney General Sessions' mind. We've seen in polls 64% of all adults approve of full legalization. That's majorities of both Democrats and Republicans. And for medical marijuana, the support is 94%.
Yeah, I've noticed those trends. And it's very interesting that you're picking up on these topics, what we could see in 2018, 2020. I wanted to ask you this, though, about Trump. As the year closed out, there was some commentary and kind of a developing narrative that all things considered, Trump didn't have a bad year. He got the tax package through toward the end there, just before Christmas. And as you say in your description of it, it does further sabotage the Affordable Care Act, which, you know, they were unable to repeal. In a sense, they are repealing a big element of it, doing away with the individual mandate. And then you look at the amount of deportations we're seeing, the enforcement of immigration laws by ICE. Even though he didn't help Roy Moore, even though there were some setbacks for the president, at the end of the year, then I started to hear people saying, it's not that bad. And the next year, some folks are going to start seeing better tax refunds because of the tax package. And some people are in certain companies are seeing bonuses already. All in all, not too bad for Trump.
Well, I mean, it's the character issue that's driving his unfavorables. It's the Twitter outburst, as you can tell, I'm a baby boomer. I've never used it, and probably never will. The tweets. He's a TV show, and he has essentially the support of a little more than a third of the public. It was enough to win in the Electoral College, but his presidency is kind of one of those black swan phenomena. It was an accident. We haven't had enormously severe consequences from his election. That's certainly true. The stock market is booming. Consumer confidence is high. And unemployment is low, although I've read an article that, you know, much of that is, you know, fueled by temporary employees who don't have full benefits. However, the tax plan certainly is going to blow up the deficit. And if there are any remaining fiscal conservatives out there, they can't be happy about that. But the world didn't end. Where is this going? I just don't see it having a happy ending in the foreseeable or long-term future.
A happy ending in whose eyes, though, Herb? I mean, because a lot of the things that Trump has done, if you're in his base, if you're one of his supporters, you probably think he's doing exactly what he said he was going to do.
I think, by and large, he has. However, long-term, cutting immigration into the United States is not a positive contribution. When you look at countries that severely limit immigration, such as Japan, there are enormous problems in terms of pension payments and economic growth. Part of the economic drive wheel of the United States is built upon an expanding population.
Especially with an aging baby boomer population.
Especially us, yes.
Yeah. Hey,
I
wanted to read you a comment I received from a friend in New York about Trump and all that's been going on here this past year during the first year of his presidency. And let me just read this, and then I'd like to get your thoughts. I think we can survive Trump the president, but I'm worried that we may not survive Trump the cultural phenomenon. The transformation that leaves millions of people convinced that there is no such thing as discernible truth, that no institutions can be trusted, that none are worth saving, that the best one can do is trust a fool of your own choosing. That's why I do not for one second think there is any particular reason to believe the Democrats will win back either House of Congress this year or the presidency. It's quite possible they will win, but our politics are so fluid, I don't see how we can safely forecast anything beyond today. The first part of that I found interesting, and I think that is what is troubling. You know, when you see fact-checking going on, you see a lot of good journalism, a lot of good reporting, and then the Trump base just, I guess, basically just dismisses it as biased, as prejudiced, as fake news, and moves on. So I wonder what you thought about that. And also the question, is there any point in the Democrats trying to win back any of Trump's base?
First, the statement was articulate, eloquent, and accurate. I mean, the idea that nothing's to be trusted in the United States it's been growing. It's not something that Donald Trump invented, but the war against the mainstream media, the liberal media, et cetera, that's as old as Spiro Agnew and Dick Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, a lie repeated will become a reality for at least some percentage of the public. What are the long-term consequences of this? It's hard to say. We have seen some media sources like the Washington Post and the New York Times have actually seen their subscriptions increase in the last year. And it's something that journalists who, you know, are trying to speak truth to power and truth to the people, you know, just have to, you know, grind it out and keep on going. There'll always be a percentage of the population that doesn't believe this. I mean, the idea of trying to reach out to Trump voters at the margin, that's possible. I mean, I would think some diehard Republicans who are fiscal conservatives, you know, may well be open to alternative messaging. But I think for the Democrats, it's energizing the base and working on turnout. That's what worked in Alabama. That's what worked in Virginia. And it could well work in 2018. I mean, the Senate will certainly be a reach because I believe 24 of the 33 seats up are held by Democrats. But the House of Representatives, even though districts remain, you know, pretty gerrymandered, that I think is well within reach if you look at some of the special elections and see how Democrats have basically increased their vote totals from the 2016-2014 margins.
Democrats need to gain 24 seats to control the House. And in those off-year elections, the president's party, according to historians, a historical look at this that I just read, the average is about 30 seats lost in midterms by the president's party, either party.
Right.
Yeah. So
right.
So we could see that. Your feeling about a Democratic wave, you think we could see this? Because it's still several months off. It's November.
November, a week is a long time in politics.
Yeah, in the Trump era,
The generic ballot, I think, most of the polls favor Democrats by close to 10 points, which would certainly bring the House within reach. If there's a Democratic majority in the House of Representatives and Nancy Pelosi is Speaker once again, that's going to really change the dynamic in Washington. We might see more meetings, as we saw the other day, on the subject of DACA.
Herb, one last thing. What did you think of the response to Oprah Winfrey's speech at the Golden Globes, this talk of her running for president?
Well, it was a magnificent series of sound bites. If suddenly celebrity is the major qualification for the American presidency, God help us all.
That was my reaction to it. Nothing against Oprah personally.
Nothing
or professionally.
Against Oprah personally.
She's an impressive, powerful person, but she's a celebrity.
Qualifications and experience, have to count. Something called competence and judgment, and these are qualities that have been celebrated for 4,000 years of human civilization.
Someone mentioned Ronald Reagan. Well, he was just a Hollywood figure who ran for president. No, he wasn't. He was two-term governor of the largest state in the country.
Two-term governor. It's interesting you brought up Reagan because I don't know if you read Mark Hertzgaard's book on Bended Knee, which was published back in 1988, but it dealt with how the media treated the incipient Alzheimer's that the president began to display in his second term, and how basically the mainstream media did not cover that, and what a difference that has become as we've become far more transparent in the 24/7 news cycle.
Herb Smith is former chair and longtime professor of political science at McDaniel College and has for years provided me and other journalists in Maryland with perspectives on national and local politics. By the way, in the latest Quinnipiac poll, Trump's approval rating is at 36%, with disapproval at 59%. 26% strongly approve of him, 53% strongly disapprove. 65% say he isn't honest, 69% say he isn't level-headed, and 65% say he doesn't share their values. Okay, after a short break, we'll talk about Maryland politics with Malia Cromer, director of the Goucher Poll.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
And Quinn Kelly's guest this week is Jessica Hyman, the DJ known as Trill Natured. The Maryland General Assembly has convened for its 90-day session, and Malia Cromer, director of the Goucher Poll, was in Annapolis for opening day. It's an interesting year because the legislature is starting for 90 days, and then there's an election in June. It's a primary in June, and some of the people in that legislature are going to be running against each other in the primaries. And, of course, the governor has to run for re-election this year, Larry Hogan. Let's start with Larry Hogan. In your polling at the Goucher Poll, he's been pretty consistently popular in with approval ratings in the 60s, right?
Mid-low 60s consistently. We saw a peak in September 2016. It peaked around 72%. If you take the aggregate of Larry Hogan's approval rating over time, I would give him a right around mid-low 60s.
And in general, in Maryland, how do people feel about the state? Right track, wrong track? How did that track?
Okay, so if you look at this over time, we've been asking about the direction of the state since 2012, since we started.
Right.
Under O'Malley, it had dipped down a little bit, I think, towards the end. And I think that's, again, the sentiment that helped put Larry Hogan into office. Larry Hogan takes office, and you see it reverse, that more people than not think the state is going on in the right direction. That was primarily driven by how thrilled Republicans and independents were. So that's where that number kind of came in. It's been consistently good throughout his time in office, but the last time we asked about the right track, wrong direction question back in September 2017, it was the first time it dropped.
By 9 points or so, wasn't it?
Yeah, it dropped.
See, I remember that statistic, yeah.
Right, because it's a big thing that kind of sticks out. And,
yeah.
And that's one of the things, if you're an incumbent, you look at that number, and you definitely take pause and you worry about it a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not sure what explains that.
It's hard to tell. I mean, I think that the general sentiment, through just the direction of the country has certainly dipped. I don't know if that's trickling down to the state level or not. But again, this is an election year too, and sometimes people are looking for a change and are looking at government with a little bit more of a critical eye, and that could perhaps what's be driving it.
Okay, well, let's talk about this then, since we're going down that track. Aaron Cox brought this up on the show. We're looking at Larry Hogan as a candidate for re-election in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Elsewhere in the country, there's talk of a Democratic wave. The New York Times story on Wednesday said some 30 Republicans in the House have decided not to run for re-election to those seats or to run for another office. And then we found out that Daryl Issa, who is an incumbent congressman from California, pretty prominent, has announced that he's not running for re-election. So I guess a concern that Trump is weighing down these candidates, his unfavorables are so low. So if there's a Democratic wave, mm-hmm. right, in 2018, big turnout, got to vote for every Democrat we possibly can, every woman we possibly can. If all this is happening, how does that play out in Maryland? Aaron's theory was it may hurt Larry Hogan. Even if he is popular, people may say, no, I'm going to vote for every possible Democrat I can.
Well, first and foremost, I think a lot of it does depend on the Democrat that gets elected and whether or gets through the primary.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this. To me, I wonder, I'm skeptical about the Democratic wave coming here to Maryland. And here's why. If we look at our congressional delegation, besides the first district and Andy Harris, Democrats, in a lot of ways, are victims of their own success. They have seven
house
out of eight
seats.
House seats. And so there's not really a Democratic wave that's going to try to take out Jamie Raskin or Anthony Brown.
Right.
Even in the sixth district, you have a bunch of really strong Democrats running on the Democratic side.
To fill the seat being vacated by
John Delaney. By Democrat
right.
John Delaney.
Right.
And we know Dan Bongino came close to unseating him, but Delaney did win handedly in the last cycle. And so where is the enthusiasm in terms of congressional seats to really gin up that vote at that level? And again, and you also look at the state legislative level.
Okay, excuse me. So
okay.
Aaron's theory is that you don't need to gin up anything because
okay.
Trump is ginning everything up.
Okay.
The Democrats are going to come out in force just so they can do it, just so they can vote for for Democrats. And independents are going to do this. That's her theory.
Sure. And that actually, and I don't discount the fact that that could actually perhaps come to fruition. I'm just wondering, though, at the national level, when large national level Democratic organizers are looking to sink money into states, are they going to spend money trying to organize activists here in Maryland where you have, again, a first district, which is the only one the Democrats could perhaps flip. If we look at the state House and the state Senate, you have a veto-proof majority for Democrats on both the state House and the state Senate side. And where are the hopes of picking up those seats? So where are the places for Democrats to win that they haven't already won at the state legislative level?
Well, then you're down to the first district.
Then you're down to the first district.
Where Andy Harris is the incumbent, who is an extremely conservative congressman, not just a Republican in the old Wayne Gilchrist mold.
No.
I don't mean to call Wayne old, but, he was a moderate Maryland Republican. that a lot of Republicans considered practically a Democrat. But Andy Harris, you know, Freedom Caucus guy, mm-hmm. voted to repeal Obamacare as many times as he could, facing possibly a challenge from a young woman, mm-hmm. Alison Galbraith, although there are others running in the primary.
So let's say best case scenario,
yeah.
if that race becomes really exciting, if Democrats can really put their full force behind Alison or whoever or any of the other challengers, mm-hmm. how many Democrats actually are there in that particular district in the Eastern Shore to maybe, is there enough there to
oh, I don't have the math here in front of me.
Make a difference? I don't know. And I think that's a central question. That being said, it might not take outside forces. So Democrats, you're right, might be just enthused enough themselves just to turn up to the polls. The question is, do they vote against the governor who has effectively distanced himself? And again, I always
from
say
Trump,
this from
yeah.
Trump. I say mm-hmm. this with a caveat because Democrats will say not enough, and he really hasn't. Or he's a conservative in moderates' clothing. But to the rank and file voter, this is Larry Hogan is an individual who decided not to vote for Donald Trump. He was really one of the first governors to say he wasn't going to. And he has taken made points to distance himself. So does that wave come here with a Republican governor who the majority of Marylanders view as a moderate?
And I'll just add that soon after Trump signed this tax overhaul, which is mm-hmm. really a great gift to the wealthy, with some crumbs to the middle class for a little while, Hogan said he was going to protect Marylanders from the consequences of this so-called tax reform that might affect them tax-wise in Maryland.
Right, and this is again consistent with that message that got him elected in 2014. But I think an important thing to note is, depending on who the person is that makes it through the Democratic primary. So we haven't heard a lot about the candidates yet.
Well,
so there was a new poll.
We can start now. Let's talk about this. That's another
about
thing.
Them.
We got a Gonzalez poll, not a Goucher poll, but no. I'm sure you guys are working on it.
We are.
but a Gonzalez poll showing Rashern Baker, the Prince George's County executive, mm-hmm. with a 24% in the poll, which basically is name recognition at this point, right, isn't it?
I think a lot of this is name recognition, but it does demonstrate to me the difference between our poll that we took back in September, which was the first of the Democratic primary poll, and we had Rashern Baker right around 13% on the head-to-head. So he has made some inroads, so you see a little bit uptick in his numbers. And I think what really indicates to me that the race is starting to finally shape up a little bit is that we had a 44% of individuals said that they didn't know. And on this most
didn't know any candidate.
They didn't know who they were going to vote for.
It was 44?
Back in September.
In Gonzalez, it was like 33.
It's 33. So okay. We've had a 10-point shift. And now we see, and Rashern Baker looks like, to some extent, has absorbed some of that.
You know what this is evidence of?
What's that?
People listening to my podcast.
I think it might be. or
because I've interviewed every candidate, including the one who just dropped out or suspended mm-hmm. her campaign, Maya Rocky Moore Cummings.
Yes.
So that leaves 7 Democrats.
It does. And a couple things have happened since September. Rashern Baker picked up those 2 really key endorsements with Senator Chris Van Hollen and Brian Frosch, who has certainly been the forefront of Maryland politics with a lot of his cases against the federal government over
challenges
the last year.
To the
Absolutely.
Trump administration. Almost every day, it seems like there's a press release coming from his office about him joining in a suit of some kind.
There is. And if you're a Maryland Democratic primary voter who's currently engaged in the race right now, that endorsement most likely means a lot to you, particularly if you're really invested in a kind of a resistance sort of politics.
Okay. And then we get down the line here a little bit. Kevin Kamenetz and Ben Jealous, the former NAACP president. Kevin Kamenetz, of course, the Baltimore County executive, mm-hmm. who won't be running for re-election for county executive. He's running for governor. They had polled around 14% in Gonzalez.
Right. So, which is a little bit of an uptick than where they were at in our last Goucher poll. So we see these 3 that are all in double digits. But again, with 33% of the votes still undecided, it's really, I think, difficult to fully discern. I wouldn't say the race is certainly, it's not decided at all. I think it's still very much wide open.
We got to see where the money comes from, too. Right?
And we'll be finding that out in a couple weeks' time.
Don't we get
here,
a
right?
campaign finance soon. Report soon?
And those things really make a difference. I think for individuals, I think particularly those who really want to unseat Hogan, the core progressive base who have never been behind Hogan since the get-go, I think they'll certainly be looking at somebody who's viable. And those fundraising numbers are certainly a really great indicator of viability if you can raise money, and particularly if you can raise money from here in Maryland.
Let me ask you a couple of questions that are Maryland issues, but also potentially national issues. Marijuana and Medicare. Okay, so marijuana. You know, we heard from Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, this past week, and this kind of a panic among the legalization crowd that we're going to go back several decades in terms of our approach toward marijuana here. And in Maryland, I know this is going to be an issue in this state, too. It already is.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of that? Does that have traction as a political issue in 2018, maybe potentially 2020?
Well, I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, Jeff Sessions' decision both hindered, but then also, I think, inspired people to try to push it forward through the states as maybe a challenge to the federal government. We've asked about this in the past in the Goucher poll several times. And Marylanders, a majority of Marylanders are supportive of legalization, and an overwhelming supermajority of Marylanders across party lines are supportive of medicinal marijuana. And I think that this is a public opinion number that we've seen dramatically shift over time. It's just like gay marriage, right? So if we go back to the 90s, it's not a majority of Americans support a legalization, and just like gay marriage, it slowly ticked over time. Mm-hmm. And again, and also, like I think, like gay marriage, once you see it legalized in the different states, you start to see this kind of turning point.
Yeah,
and
it really moves fast.
Once you start to legalize in the state, it moves fast. I think individuals look towards Colorado, and especially at a time we're discussing shortfalls, right,
and budgetary revenue.
Revenue.
Yeah.
And it's almost like this really easy, low-hanging fruit. And what I think was particularly interesting, something that stuck out to me in Annapolis, were individuals who are business advocates talking about it. So they're talking about marijuana as an industry. And that really, I think, even pulls the heartstrings, I think, of a lot of Republicans who are perhaps against it for more moralistic reasons. But when they look at the kind of the idea of being able to generate revenue and the idea of taking your hands off small businesses and letting small businesses thrive. Mm-hmm. And that really speaks, I think, to a kind of core conservative issues.
Oh, yeah. That's the libertarian part of
Absolutely.
Republicanism, right? And if a young man or young woman is graduating from college, to go back to the graduate 1968, Dustin Hoffman, Anne Bancroft, I got one word for you, son or young woman. Hemp. Grow hemp. We're going to legalize hemp again in the United States, and you're going to be a hemp grower. Anyway, here's the other thing. So Medicare, I brought this up. This takes us back to the first district, congressional district here, and Andy Harris and all of his votes against the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. as thousands of people in his district benefit from the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. I wonder if this is going to rub off here at some point where people are going to put two and two together, connect the dots and say, this guy has been voting against something that my family benefits from. My son is able to get Medicaid in Maryland because he doesn't make enough money and he doesn't have an employer who provides him with insurance. My daughter was able to get a pretty decent thing, although the premium's a little too high. They got to do something about that, but at least she has insurance. And this guy's been voting against it. You know, it seems like there's been this disconnect ever since Obamacare came on the scene, but now maybe people are figuring it out because Obamacare has become more popular.
I was just going to mention that. So that's, I think, the most important thing to point out about the Affordable Care Act, that it's had this really, really interesting relationship with people's public perceptions of it. In the beginning, people didn't like Obamacare. It had enough kind of political push behind it to get it enacted into law, but then there was parts that people didn't like. But then we see when it starts to get threatened, once people start to actually benefit from having Obamacare or having health care in general, they get a little bit nervous when that is threatened from them. So you see kind of an ebb and flow of opinion towards it. Right now, it's certainly on an uptick. Where the rubber will hit the road with healthcare policy is if CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program for low-income kids, if that's not reauthorized by the Congress, if that's not funded, and we really start to see, and people start to see low-income children being stripped of their healthcare, that's when that is going to be a really big issue. And it will come here to the states because Maryland most definitely, and it's both leaders of the House and the Senate.
I talk about funding it.
Funding, as well as Governor Hogan, I think, have talked about if the Children's Health Insurance Program is not reauthorized, the state will step in.
I saw a graph the other day that Chris Van Hollen put out on a tweet showing the defense budget of the U.S. government and the budget in general, the tax breaks that are going to the upper 1% in the next 10 years compared to what CHIP costs. And it was, I mean, it's ridiculous. The Republicans still haven't reauthorized. Of course, they still might.
Right.
But you're right. It's sort of more acute as an issue than even Obamacare is, because it involves kids. It's something that they could easily be taken care of, right?
It's all these issues. Like, why do you think politicians love to use children as a backdrop? And I hate to look at it like look at it terrible and politically like that. But anytime you see an image of it, you realize like it's like a child who's going to lose their health insurance. It's the same reason with DACA. So of all the hot button immigration issues, if you look at public opinions towards DACA, that is the one issue that sort of can cross party lines in terms of immigration, where you don't see Republicans take such a hard line on immigration, is opinions for, towards the Deferred Act for
so
childhood arrivals.
Does this mean that Trump actually pays attention to polling?
Yes,
because
I think he does.
He had a bipartisan group from Congress, and not the usual people, not Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell, but other people, Dianne Feinstein, to talk about, you know, immigration overhaul. But, of course, the same day, a judge, a federal judge, is ruling against his rescinding of the DACA provisions. And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, is calling this outrageous. And the president says this is evidence that the court system is broken. And then I just saw a news story about ICE agents going to 7-Eleven stores around the country to conduct inquisitions of employees. And so it's a real mixed message still coming from Trump on immigration.
I think it's an absolutely mixed message, but I will tell you that I think the message from the American public is, and we polled about DACA here in the past in Maryland, and Marylanders are supportive of DACA. And so I really think whatever happens at the federal level with immigration reform, it will have to include some sort of provision to protect some of these individuals who brought here as kids. And that, again, goes back to our conversations about CHIP, is that really nobody wants to see a child sick without health insurance.
Okay, one step up from that is this question about health care for all, health insurance for all, Medicare for everybody, basically. Because the ACA has been kicked around so much, there have been acts of sabotage, really, by the Trump administration, and the tax bill takes away the individual mandate, so they found a way to further damage Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Is it possible that this could become a bigger issue again in the presidential campaign, if not in 2018, at least in 2020 in the presidential?
Well,
is it possible?
Healthcare is always, it'll come back up again, right?
It's not resolved.
It's not resolved. If anything, it's even more in flux than it was before. The question is whether it comes to Annapolis during this legislative session. And I don't know if that'll be the case. I think things right now are really too in flux. I think one thing that the General Assembly will certainly address it is CHIP if it does not become reauthorized. And we'll see the Democratic gubernatorial candidates talk about different ideas and their kind of view of a state-run healthcare system if the federal government
stabilizing the health insurance market.
Exactly.
Right?
So these questions certainly might come up. But everything will happen, I think, this legislative session on the backdrop of budgetary priorities. And so one thing that the Republican tax bill will do, and what Democrats are expecting it to do, it will bring some sort of windfall of extra additional money to the state. And the question will then be, what do we do with that money?
The governor wants to give it back to people, right? He doesn't want anybody's taxes going up.
Right. He wants to give it back to people.
Especially in an election year.
Well, no.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think if I was an incumbent, I'd want people's taxes to go up during an election year either. But to be honest with you, that was part of his message, what he ran. And that is a consistent Larry Hogan message.
But can he do it?
But can he do it?
Given the changes that have just taken place in Congress and how that affects state and local taxes, right?
And becomes a lot more difficult to do with this really dominant narrative coming out of Baltimore City that happened to make national news with the problems of a public school system.
Yeah.
And so you have these kind of competing conversations with how much the schools are being funded, whether there's mismanagement, if that's the problem, if they're being funded enough and mismanagement is the problem, or if they're just underfunded by the formulas and they need help and additional assistance from the state. And if you have money and you have this kind of competing priorities, what do you do with it?
The politics of that is really interesting.
And that's why pot becomes so interesting, doesn't it? Right? So like if they say sessions aside, right, let's say there's any sort of reversal or there's a way that, you know, the state's kind of push forward. Imagine that windfall of revenue. And
a tax on marijuana.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what do lawmakers do with it? I don't think they'll make the same mistakes they did with the casino money.
You mean they'll get more of it?
Well, no, I think that.
Because some people think we don't have a big enough tax on the casinos.
Right. And I think the issue with the casinos is it's not doesn't just go into an education lockbox that can only be used for, you know, city schools.
Oh, you mean discretion.
Exactly.
Yeah, so they can use it for other things.
And I think that it'll be interesting to see if this sort of like, it might not happen this session, but moving forward, right, if we do legalize marijuana and if we do have all these dispensaries and how they actually deal with that tax revenue. Like, do they actually direct it towards things like improving the public education system or does it go right into the general fund?
Mm-hmm.
I do not know.
Well, it's really going to be an interesting year, isn't it?
Yes. I also heard some rumblings about sports betting.
In Annapolis?
Yes, that somebody brought it up today. Like, what, you know, whether we actually, if it becomes possible, if we can legalize sports betting here in Maryland.
I mean, what's the argument against it?
We already have slots.
You have slots.
Horses.
You have table games.
I guess. Yeah, you'd have to ask somebody other than me. And my husband loves sports betting. So.
So you get a little troubled sometimes by the revenue from vices, basically.
And yeah, I think that there's part of me who always, yeah.
Where are we going to draw the line on this, you know?
Maybe the line will be drawn on sports betting. I don't know.
Well, Malia, come back again, will you please? Because it's going to be an interesting year, month by month.
Yes, and we'll have a new poll coming out sometime in late February.
And oh, good.
I have a whole list of issues that I heard from different folks when I was in Annapolis, and hopefully it's going to be a really robust poll.
Oh, give us one. Just tease me. Give me one more that you're thinking about polling on.
So I'm very interested in whether – so you always hear politicians talk about how Washington is terrible and Annapolis is where they get things done. I'm interested in asking people if they actually think there's less corruption in our state government than Washington, D.C., and I'm interested to see if people's perceptions of their tax burdens under Larry Hogan, if they think the taxes have increased, decreased, or had made no difference at all. And I'm really interested to see if the state thinks Baltimore City schools are underfunded. And so that to me, by the way, we'll talk about this, I guess, some other time, is the regionalism of Maryland politics, the competing kind of centers of power between Baltimore Metro and the capital counties and then everybody else. And I think that's really... We're all guilty, I think, of those of us who live in Baltimore. We have a very Baltimore-centered kind of view of the political world.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to realize, I think, those folks in the capital counties don't look at Baltimore City politics the same way that we do.
They've turned a harder eye toward us, generally, I think. Yeah.
Yes.
Although they soften their view a bit when they come here to talk on the podcast. Malia, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan.
Malia Cromer is an associate professor of political science and the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College, and in that role, she oversees the Goucher poll. One footnote to our conversation, campaign finance reports for Maryland candidates come out next week. Josh Kurtz reports in Maryland Matters that at least one Democratic gubernatorial candidate crossed the $1 million threshold in money raised in 2017. Alec Ross, former Hillary Clinton tech advisor who polled at just 1% in that Gonzalez survey we mentioned, says he has raised just over $1 million for his campaign. Josh Kurtz says next week's campaign finance reports could reorder the Democratic race, depending on how certain contenders do. And Governor Larry Hogan is expected to show a huge haul. Well, that's our show for today. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.